Welcome to episode 22 of Eye on Horror. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me yet again, as always and forever, Jacob Davidson. How you doing, Jacob?
Doing good, and I guess we're stuck together in some kind of podcast purgatory for all time.
Podcast purgatory, I like that. And also stuck in podcast purgatory with us is Jonathan Correa. How you doing, John?
You think I'm stuck in here with you? You're stuck in here with me.
Hey, guess what, you guys?
What?
We have been doing this for 1 year.
Woo!
Happy birthday to us. Woohoo! Yeah.
Hey, guys, I got a Facebook reminder that a year ago this past week, I was stuck in a steaming hot car in Waco. talk about purgatory.
Yeah, that was
a religious experience.
That was also probably our worst sounding episode, too. So not only did you almost die, but we sounded like crap. Also, to celebrate our 1 year, it was brought to our attention. I don't think any of us even thought of it, but it was brought to our attention by Anthony, our editor at iHorror, that podcasts come in seasons. So we're going to make this episode our season one finale.
Which is news to me, but that's only because I don't listen to podcasts. I was like, they come in seasons? Oh, okay.
They come and go. Some of them do, some of them don't. The ones that don't, I think, are super regular, like the ones that are like every week. I don't think they bother with it. But then the ones that do come in seasons will take a little break, which we're not going to do. You probably won't notice a break between our seasons. But next episode will be season two, I guess. But on with season one, and we have to charge forward because there was a little bit of delays in recording, you know, for numerous reasons, and we have a lot to talk about because of that. So let's jump into things, and the thing that I want to talk about most, and you guys probably do, and everyone wants to hear about most, Us.
Yeah.
Us came out.
Mm-hmm. Us.
What do you guys think of Us? I know this is one of the rare things that all three of us have seen, so let's go.
Thanks to that delay.
Yeah. So what'd you guys think about Us?
I really loved it. I thought it was a great horror movie, and I mean, I should have, but I didn't expect it to be they have as so many social messages because, you know, like from the trailers, it looked, you know, like a home invasion movie, and Jordan Peele billed it as a home invasion movie. But, you know, the more you think about it, the more meaning there is, the deeper you go in.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it does boil down to a home invasion movie. He's not lying when he says that, but there's what that just scratches the surface. There, it goes way deeper than that, and it's not quite as socially relevant, I don't think, as Get Out, but it is still there. I mean, I've actually seen it twice, and the second time might have raised more questions than it answered, and that's not a bad thing. It's one of the, like, I think Get Out was the same way, where you benefit from the multiple watches. It's crazy. I mean, short answer is I loved it as well. Not as much as Get Out, but I did love it. What about you, Kriya?
I fully agree. I will say I did like Get Out more, but I absolutely loved Us. What I loved, it was just like a very beautifully shot film. The acting was absolutely phenomenal on all levels. Like Tim Heidecker and Elizabeth Ross, when they casted them and said that they were going to be a couple, I'm like, I don't see it. But holy shit, like, they did a really good job with both them and Lupita and all the other actors of really showing that difference between the tethered and the normal folk. And on
top, because everybody basically plays two roles. They play themselves, and then they play the doppelganger. And the doppelganger is not just a twin. It's like an evil version. And
like there'll a feral version.
Yeah, and there will be subtle differences, but and that's where the masterfulness, is that even a word?
Close enough.
Sure.
that's where the masterfulness of the acting is on display when, like, you know, like Winston Duke plays himself and then he plays the evil him. And there's actually a funny part where he's talking, where they're counting kills, and he goes, and minor spoiler, he goes, I killed myself.
Right.
It's totally awesome. But all of the actors, and I especially loved the evil Tim Heidecker character was so Eric Trump. It was totally...
Well, that's one interpretation.
Well, that's one of the things that, especially out of, if we're talking about, like, specifically the performances, because I thought that was the most standout thing about it. Like, all the subtle nuances that Peele put throughout the film with the imagery and a lot of, like, the fact that the film wore its influences on its sleeve to the point where it opens up with a TV having the VHSs next to it being, like,
oh, yeah,
basically being, like, these are the films that we took inspiration from,
yeah,
which fucking love the Invasion of the Body Snatchers Leonard Nimoy references, you know?
Well, and also, yeah, you know, it's, like, Chud and the Goonies, and you're, yep, I mean, it's almost, yeah, it's kind of like a spoiler, but it's more of like a keep your eye out for these things.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's...
But it's the performances that made it, though, because even, like, especially the Tethered, how they weren't, like, it wasn't like, oh, it's Spock and a goatee. Like, there was so much,
yeah,
like, to them that was like this, and it wasn't just like a weird, twisted version of them. It was, they, like, a lot of the performances came out as more than that. Like, it was these people that were so connected to us that they, once they were on the surface, they were like trying to find their own identities within that. And you see that, like, especially with Moss's Tethered and Heidecker's Tethered and all that. It was and it, like, the more I think about it, the more it, like, explains a few issues I had with some of the mythology behind the Tethered. I thought, which I love. I love, yeah, films that make me keep revisiting it in my head throughout the week, you know?
That's the thing I really love, though, the mythology of the movie, is that, you know, it isn't just a home invasion movie, and, you know, it's like, it's a lot deeper than that. Like, you know, just watching the trailers alone, I could get a sense that there was something scarier to this than just, you know, like a home invasion or doubles. It was, you know, kind of that element of cosmic horror, which reminded me of this Japanese horror author, Junji Ito, whose works, you know, like, he does these horror stories that can involve things like cloning or hauntings or stuff, but he adds just that, like, cosmic element to it, like, of Lovecraft that just elevates it into, you know, just something out of a nightmare, you know.
Korea brought up the fact that it's beautifully shot, and I just wanted to give a shout out. The cinematographer, I think you say his name, it's Mike Gillilocus or whatever, something like, he shot It Follows as well.
Yeah, which,
perfect.
It Follows and Us are probably two of the most stylishly shot movies of the 2010s. So,
yeah,
you know, he's got two of them, you know, and he's got a great eye. Let's power through some more things that we've seen. I saw Gaspar Noé's Climax.
Ooh. Yeah, how was that?
It's a Gaspar Noé movie.
It's the highest compliment, and also not.
Yeah, no, it's about a dance troupe that basically they form this dance troupe, and they come up with this routine, and they nail the routine, so they're like, all right, let's have a party. So they start having a party in their rehearsal space, but someone spikes the sangria with LSD. So it goes from just, you know, let's party, to, you know, everybody has their own bad trip, and when they're all combined, it's a pretty, I mean, it's borderline horror, but, you know, it's Gaspar Noé, so, you know, the cool thing about it is, speaking of cinematography, it is shot, I swear, the whole second half of the movie, once the trips really start kicking in, is shot in one long shot with just a steady cam, you know, running around following different characters. But it starts kind of similarly to Us, whereas, you know, it shows interviews with the people, like their audition interviews, but then on the side there'll be like Eraserhead or Suspiria or Sallow 120 Days of Sodom, you know, all this stuff that is giving you kind of a little glimpse to what's going to happen
all
later.
Great movies, by the way, to be watching on acid, especially if you're not told that you're going to be doing acid, you know.
Yeah, but it's crazy. It's kind of like a drug trip itself. It's got a banging soundtrack, though, that never lets up, though, because there's basically a DJ spinning for the party, and it's got, you know, like, it takes place in, I think, 96, so it's, you know, period, you know, Gary Newman, Daft Punk, you know, that kind of cool stuff. So yeah, it's nutty, but I know you're dying to tell us what you saw, Korea.
Well, I saw a few things. First of all, I want to talk about something that we all possibly could have seen. Did you guys watch the premiere episode of What We Do in the Shadows?
Yes.
Oh, no. It's on my DVR. Oh. I have not seen it yet.
All I have to say, I don't want to spoil anything about it, but all I have to say is they translated it well. Of course, mm-hmm. I was a little worried that it wasn't going to be the same characters, but you know what? I'm kind of glad, because even though it's a new set of vampires and it takes place in America on Staten Island, the essence, the humor, everything is still there, and it works phenomenally. Like, I've already watched that pilot 3 or 4 times this week, and it's just as funny the first time. And a special shout out to Matt Berry, who is consistently always funny, and he absolutely kills it in the show as well. So I'm always going to be excited for new episodes. But Doug Jones does have a cameo in the first episode.
Yeah.
So that should tell you how some of the weird shit that goes on in it.
But what else have you seen?
Another great show that actually premieres tomorrow. So by the time this episode comes out, these episodes will already come out. I got to I'm reviewing for iHorror.com the new Twilight Zone show.
Nice.
That's executive produced by Jordan Peele. And let me tell you, it is fucking phenomenal.
Sweet.
I'm going to put it out there already because I know a few sites are already talking about it and complaining about it. It's not, at least with the first two episodes, because I still have yet to watch and review the third and fourth episodes. They're not big so far on twist endings. It seems more like the show is establishing the weirdness of the week and or the moral or whatever, you know, the Twilight Zone-esque aspect of the show is early on in the episode. And then you're just in it for the entire duration of the episode. And there's no like cutting away from it, basically. And I think the biggest testament to this show, especially if you watch the first two episodes, is just how the lack of the, like, for main character wise, like, almost there's no white people as like the main good guy or anything like that. And I think that's phenomenal. And their take on 30,000 feet or Nightmare at 30,000 feet was great. I mean,
isn't Adam Scott the William Shatner / John Lithgow character?
Yeah, but what they do with it is phenomenal. And
okay,
because
he's white. I don't know if you noticed.
I noticed. Oh shit, a little spoiled, but you have to know that. And I was excited because I was like, oh man, we've seen the story a few times with George Miller's in the movie and Shatner in the original series. And I think they did a version of it in the 80s revival or the 2000s movie, but
I think that was it.
Oh,
yeah, I think it's just Shatner and Lithgow.
Yeah.
Okay. Beautiful, because this one's awesome and it really like is a product of its time in a post 9/11, you know, air travel. And not only that, but it tackles a lot of issues that we're seeing a lot of in 2019. And then the second episode, The Comedian, I was really expecting it to be some sort of like Faustian story with like Tracy Jordan basically being the devil, kind of like what Burgess Meredith did in the original series.
Wait, you mean Tracy Morgan?
Or Tracy Morgan, yeah.
Yeah, Tracy Jordan's his character on 30 Rock.
Dude, it's such a subtle change that he's doing that. But yeah, Tracy Morgan, and it was phenomenal.
I'm not going to edit that out either.
Don't. I make that mistake a lot. And I can't, but I can't be blamed. Like, that's 7 seasons of 30 Rock, you know? I've seen more content of him going by Tracy Jordan than I have of him going by Tracy Morgan. So.
Nobody can blame you. That's why I'm not going to edit it out. Now, are they all remakes of older episodes or just Nightmare at 20,000 Feet?
So far, that's the only one that I've seen. There's like some where you can see like their influences by previous ones. Like The Comedian, you can see influences from previous episodes, but they do something completely different with it. Even 30,000 Feet isn't like the original. I'm trying not to spoil that one because that one caught me off pretty well. And podcasts actually play a big part in it too, which I thought was funny. But it's phenomenal. Definitely worth, like, I'm honestly thinking about getting CBS All Access now between that and Star Trek Discovery. Like, they're pretty killing it. I'm not going to watch Young Sheldon though. I don't give a fuck about that.
Oh, Young Sheldon is on CBS All Access? Is it not on regular CBS?
They have like the previous episodes, but I don't care about that child. I don't care.
Well, no, my wife watches that, so maybe between The Twilight Zone and Young Sheldon, we'll have to get CBS All Access. But anyway, I digest.
It's like $7.99 or $6.99, something like that.
Yeah,
it's not bad.
It's affordable. But now, this still isn't what I know you've seen and you want to talk about. So tell us what you saw.
So I saw Pet Sematary.
Which, by the time this posts, it'll have been out for a weekend, yeah. So everyone will have seen it. But at this point, none of us have seen it. My screening's Wednesday.
It's phenomenal. Like, first of all, I'm not gonna get into the audience. I was very disappointed with the audience that I saw it with, but the film itself is great. At the end of the day, Pet Sematary, yes, it is a horror film, but it's all about grievance and dealing with death and loss, and that this film exemplifies that more so than the horror. The horror is definitely there. There are some genuinely scary parts, but like the scenes of dealing with death and grieving are so intense and just like keep you in it. And yeah, they did make a few changes. I would highly recommend not watching the full trailer for this, because it's better to go in not knowing any of the changes that they made from the original material or the previous adaptation. But it is phenomenal. And I don't know how they did, like, they said they had 8 different cats playing Church, but holy shit, was that like great direction with those cats, because that cat came off super creepy. Like, if there was a best acting for animals, like, that cat would win.
There should be everything. Because Black Phillip should have gotten it. Steven Seagal should have gotten it.
Yeah.
Although they would have been up against each other. I think that was the same year.
Keanu should have gotten it.
Oh, yeah.
But it was great. And John Lithgow was phenomenal. They kind of addressed one of the big issues I've always had with the book and the previous movie, where I know I'm not alone in screaming at that character. Why the fuck did you show the father the Pet Sematary in the first place? Like, why did you show this to him? And they kind of explained it a bit more, or at least gave more motivation behind that decision in this one, which... But they didn't over-explain it. You know what I mean? I thought they handled it pretty well.
So now, one more thing. You're talking about spoilers. Please don't spoil this for anybody if you know what they changed, because it's already been spoiled for me because of another internet site, not iHorror, but another one that I follow on Facebook. Freaking spoiled the biggest change, and I'm so pissed that I didn't get to discover it on myself. And also someone in the iHorror fan group also to a lesser extent kind of spoiled it, but it was a little more vague. But yeah. One of the big horror websites just totally spoiled the biggest change, and I'm so pissed.
Damn. In the headline too.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's like, come on.
I'm lucky
let
you managed
people
to dodge
figure
it.
That out. Yeah, yeah. Set one of those filters on your Facebook for Pet Sematary so that this doesn't pop up for you, because it's too late for me. Save yourself, Jacob.
I gotta hold on until Wednesday.
But also, no, it's not the only one.
Okay,
and
that's good to know.
There's not a whole lot. It's not like they made a radically different film. The essence and the character, everything is still there. They just made like a bunch of changes that worked really well for this interpretation, and they do also a really good job of faking out with a few things, and the jump scares are on fucking point. Like, I'm usually like one of those type of people that's like, oh, jump scares are a bit of a cop out, but when they're done right, holy shit, are they done right? And they made me jump a few times with a few of them.
So I have a couple quick ones to burn through, because I knew we were going to take a long time on talking about what we've seen because it's been so long. But there seems to be the new trend in Hollywood seems to be Charles Manson movies, because we've got the new Tarantino coming out, which it remains to be seen how Charles Manson it's actually going to be. But there's also one called Charlie Says and another one called Tate. But there's one that the one that beat them all to the punch is called The Haunting of Sharon Tate. And it is it was written and directed by Daniel Farrens, who did the Amityville murders that we talked about a few episodes ago. And it pretty much is kind of the same type thing. It takes the factual events of, you know, the Tate LaBianca murders, and it sticks to them pretty solidly, but it adds this little twist where Sharon Tate has premonitions about the murder. That's her haunting. You know, she has dreams and premonitions and like just weird feelings that something bad is going to happen. So it's a, I can't say that it's good. I really, really want to like Daniel Farren's movies because he's the guy who did all those documentaries, the really long ones about Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th, what Never Sleep Again and Crystal Lake Memories, I think they're called. He did those, I think.
Oh, okay.
So it doesn't surprise me that he's good at adapting true life, you know, events like the Amityville murders or the Tate-LaBianca murders. But I really wish that I liked both the Amityville murders and the Haunting of Sharon Tate more than I did, but they just seem kind of eh, you know, they're okay. But another thing I saw, and I know Jacob has seen it as well, The Book of Monsters.
Yeah. Which I reviewed it for the site.
It is, that is a lot of fun.
Yep.
The Book of Monsters is, it basically is about a girl who's having, well, her friends throw her a birthday party and invite her whole school, and also a bunch of monsters, I think six in total, tag along to the party and they're summoned by a book, which it's explained, you know, where the book comes from and everything. But this girl and her friends have to fight off these monsters. And it's the thing that struck me most about it. It's kind of like a girl power movie because the dudes are completely useless. All the guys, I mean, even more useless than normally in horror movies they are. But the girls, you know, take charge and just kick ass through the whole thing. And it's all practical effects. It's just slimy and gooey. What'd you think of it, Jacob?
I enjoyed it. Like, yeah, I mean, it definitely showed its budget. It was pretty low budget, but it had a lot of heart. And yeah, the creature effects were pretty outstanding, all things considered, and very imaginative, because it wasn't, you know, like vampires or werewolves or whatever. It's like there was a shape-shifting insect monster. There were like little gooey zombie dwarves. There was like a big like Wendigo monster stomping people. So yeah, I feel like they did a pretty good job. And speaking of girl power, it was also interesting that the lead character was also lesbian, and like the romance subplot was her being in love with another girl, which very rare for a horror movie like that.
The thing about Book of Monsters, it's, I mean, you mentioned its micro budget. It was actually Kickstartered in, I think, is it from New Zealand, I think, is where they made it? Ireland, maybe? Or?
England. It was England.
Okay. I know you have somewhere else. And they did a Kickstarter, but it wasn't just any old Kickstarter where you donate and you get, you know, a t-shirt and a DVD. They let the backers choose what the monsters were going to look like, one of the weapons that was going to be used, one of the lines that was going to be said. You know, they there were a bunch of things that they let their backers vote on. So everybody who donated, you know, $5 or $10 to this movie got a say in the final movie.
Nice.
And so, you know, you talked about the creature design. I think that you got to vote on maybe three designs per creature. I mean, they didn't just, you know, send in a sketch if you send us $10. You know, you had to vote on three pre-existing things. I actually looked it up and looked at the Kickstarter afterwards and, you know, looked at it, and it was It's pretty cool how they did that. I thought it really gives, you know, it gives the Kickstarter backers, you know, a feeling of, oh, we're part of the team, you know, which essentially they are, because the movie wouldn't have gotten made without without them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's awesome, having that involvement with your investors, especially when it comes to like Kickstarter or something like that, where you're not getting kickback on the revenue and whatnot. So to see your stamp and your contribution be a part of something like that is pretty awesome. Not to mention just what Dread Central is doing with Dread Central Present and putting out a new and so far good and unique horror films every month is absolutely phenomenal. I respect everything they're doing with that right now.
They have a pretty good track record. I mean, they're like, obviously Terrifier was how do you say it? Terrifier.
Terrifier.
That Art the Clown movie, that was a Dread Central one. The Lodgers was one. I mean, they've
the
got
Golem
to Hell and Back.
They got some good. Yeah, they're putting up a pretty good track record.
All right, so I won a copy of The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires from Dead Right Horror Trivia a bit ago.
Nice.
And yeah, that's coming out from Scream Factory in April, I think in a week or two. And yeah, it was my first time watching it. It was a lot of fun. I'd heard mixed things, but yeah, so basically, you know, it's from the 70s. At the time, Hammer was trying to figure out what would be big success, so they figured horror movies are big, kung fu movies are big, let's make a kung fu horror movie. So they teamed up with the Shaw brothers, got Peter Cushing, and decided to make a kung fu vampire movie. And it's actually pretty fun. I mean, it's not the most well-plotted Hammer movie by any means, but yeah, performances are pretty decent. There's a lot of cool choreography, and it's just cool to see, you know, people fighting vampires with kung fu and vampires using kung fu. Peter Cushing, unfortunately, does not use kung fu, but he does fight people who use kung fu. So,
damn, that would have been cool to see Peter Cushing do kung fu, because that man could do anything.
How does he fight them? Does he box or does he use weapons?
You know, just stake. You know, he uses like a cross, stakes. Oh, but yeah, it would have been funny if he went for the old fisty cuffs.
That's right.
Like a good old English gentleman. I mean, he just uses, you know, like typical Van Helsing stuff, like crossbow, stake, and hammer, you know, that type of stuff. But yeah, it's cool.
Right on.
Yeah.
Let's move on to our subgenre, and it's kind of a downer this time, but what do we got?
Well, rather than doing an outright horror subgenre, we decided to honor the memory of the late, great Larry Cohen by talking about the films of Larry Cohen.
Yes, and I'm going to go first because my favorite is Q, The Winged Serpent.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, if any of you don't know Larry Cohen, I mean, you probably know his movies, but you might not know he was the king of guerrilla filmmaking. It was one of those ask for forgiveness instead of permission when it came to getting permits.
Yeah, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness.
So Q, The Winged Serpent is about Quetzalcoatl, and he's flying around New York, and there's one scene where they're shooting at the Winged Serpent with guns, and I guess he got the cops called on him because people said, there's a guy with a machine gun on the Chrysler building.
And of course they didn't actually have like a giant monster to show people, because he was claymation, so there's just like people shooting in the air, right?
Yeah,
that's another great thing is the creature is like some Harryhausen claymation. So, between that and like just huge
claws to grab people.
Yeah.
And I love that story because I was watching the documentary about him, you know, King Cohen, and like the story was told by John Landis because he was shooting Trading Places at the time in New York, and while he was shooting some scenes, like all the cops that were, you know, on his set had to go to the Chrysler building to investigate the shooting, and it was just like, oh, it's just some dude shooting a movie, shooting in the air. And that was the thing. They were using the Chrysler building because in the movie Q was using it as its nest, and it
lays his eggs. Yeah,
and it was under construction at the time, or renovation, so they were able to, and that's how they were able to use the Chrysler building.
Yeah, able to break in and shoot in the Chrysler.
Yeah, and the thing I really love about Q, The Winged Serpent is, well, remember how when J.J. Abrams was promoting Cloverfield, he was talking like, you know, there hasn't really been that many traditional American giant monsters, because, you know, like Japan's got Godzilla, and I mean, we kind of have King Kong, but I feel like Q is a very quintessentially American monster, you know, based out of Aztec folklore, but you know, it's the way Larry Cohen framed it, because, you know, it's like this big winged monster's just going around New York City grabbing people and eating people,
and New York was like a huge set piece for his films too, because my go-to is God Told Me To, or the extended title God Told Me to Kill, which is just quintessential New York in its setting and everything. I saw a print of it at CineFamily when that was still a thing here in LA. I think Jacob, you and I were talking about it before that. You were at that same screening and we didn't know each other then.
And the great thing about that was that we saw the Whisper Cut,
right,
which was the version that had a lot of, I believe it was test cues from Bernard Herrmann. Yeah, because he died before he was able to finish.
Yeah, he that was basically like going to be his next thing. And like they were all set and ready for him to score it, which is why they have this cut that uses a lot of his cues from other movies, including like Psycho and a few others. And then he died before he could actually write the score. But he was really excited for it. And if you don't know God Told Me To, holy shit, is that film still relevant? Because it's all about people randomly pulling massacres all across the city, like randomly going to the top of like a water tower or something and just picking off people with sniper rifles. And every time someone catches them before they, you know, off themselves or get or death by or suicide by cops, they tell them God told me to. And it turns out later on it's this genderless Jess Franco character, and it goes into how he's like an alien, and all. It gets real weird towards the end, but it's absolutely phenomenal. And another testament to Cohen's guerrilla filmmaking, there's a scene where it takes place during a police parade.
St. Patrick's Day.
Huh? Yeah.
Yes. Wasn't it like a St. Patrick's Day police parade?
It's a St. Paddy's.
St. Patrick's Day police parade. So it's all these cops, and with no permits at all, they had Andy Kaufman, fucking Taxi Man from Moon himself, go in dressed up as a cop and just start freaking the fuck out and pulls out a gun and all this stuff. But because they're following him around with all these cameras, the cops just go, oh, they must have their permits and stuff, and just go with it. And like didn't get in trouble. And but that was also during the 70s when they were trying to get a lot of like film productions there too, which is why Maniac got away with a lot of their shenanigans as well. But it's just a testament to the, again, he never asked for permission, just always would ask for apologies or ask for forgiveness later. And yeah, he's gonna be sorely missed. That's for sure.
He sure is. And of course, can't talk about Larry Cohen without bringing up one of his quintessential movies, The Stuff.
Yes, The Stuff.
Which Love The Stuff.
Which I like to think of as Cohen's Dawn of the Dead, because it was, you know, aside from that, you know, like one of the most anti-consumerist horror movies of all time, because it's basically about like this new snack sensation is taking the nation. Like, and you know, keep in mind, this is like early to mid 80s. So this is like when commercial culture is like really everywhere, and like you know, commercials with catchphrases and stuff really big, because they even have a joke about the, you know, where's the beef thing from the 80s. And they have the same woman do it in the movie, like, where's the stuff? And so it's basically about I forget his name. He was the lead in Q. He's in a bunch of Coen's
Michael
movies.
Moriarty.
Yeah, Michael Moriarty. Yeah. He plays a industrial saboteur hired by these snack companies to figure out why the stuff is so addictive and why everybody loves it. And he finds out it's like a living thing, and it wants you to eat it, because when you eat it, it takes you over and controls your brain. So it's basically about him getting wrapped up in all this other craziness and trying to stop the stuff from being sold to consumers,
which has one of the greatest like monster discovery scenes, because the stuff is, it looks like a cross between like marshmallow and like shaving cream, and it just comes out of the ground. So like when they first discover it, it's like a couple of like oil drillers or something, so there's like this white shit in the ground, and they're like, what is this stuff? And then one of them just goes like, I don't know, let's taste it, or something like along those lines, and just puts it in his mouth. And it's just like, it's one of those things where it's just like, what was going through your head where you're like, hey, there's some weird shit coming out of the ground, let's put it in our mouths.
if either of you guys saw something that looked like that coming out of the ground, would your first you know impulse be, let's taste it?
No, I sure, grew up why in the not? Woods. I grew up in the woods. We'd see weird shit coming out of the ground all the time and be like, nope, don't touch that. That's probably poison. That's what I've learned, is that anything that looks cool is probably poison.
Yeah, that's a good philosophy.
We also can't talk about Larry Cohen without mentioning his first horror movie, It's Alive.
Yes.
Because It's Alive was one of those, it was actually made in 74, but it kind of, it flopped in 74, but then they re-released it with a better ad campaign in 77. And that's the ad campaign that seriously messed me up, because the TV commercial is like a little bassinet kind of spinning around. And the voiceover says something like, all parents are a little scared. The Davises are terrified. You know, and it brings up the title of the movie. It says something like, the one big problem with the Davises' kid, it's alive. And then this little claw is coming out of the, and it's so traumatizing. I mean, talk about kinder trauma. I'm like, you know, but of course I had to see the movie.
Yeah.
Little 7-year-old me is like, Mom, Dad, this movie. I want nightmares for a week.
And yeah, and again, you know, it's just a real testament to Coen's writing and that he always managed to put in a very strong social message in his movies, no matter what the framing was. Because the big theme in It's Alive was, you know, like pollution and chemical infection, like all this crap that's happening to the environment is starting to affect people, and in this case, it's affected pregnancy so bad that it creates mutants.
Well, it was also there's a pharmaceutical corruption subplot as well. This is a little spoilery, but it's, you know, like a 35-year-old movie. It came out that like some drug that all the that these women right. were taking was so, and there was also like an abortion angle to it too. It was like a smorgasbord of social issues that he wrapped up into one movie.
And that's the thing. He was inspired by the thalidomide cases, you know. Which, again, you know, it's amazing that he would tackle such a heavy subject in the framing of a movie like It's Alive, which if anything, makes it all the stronger.
Well, It's Alive is his first horror movie, and he had toyed with a little bit of blaxploitation.
Yeah.
But he was mainly a writer. I mean, he had a pretty successful writing career mm-hmm. before that, writing, you know, in the 60s, and he continued writing because he wrote, like, you know, stuff like Phone Booth for Joel yeah. Schumacher
and yep. Cellular.
And Cellular.
He and Maniac wrote, you know, Cop.
Yeah, Maniac Cop. Also, Uncle Sam, which I think we talked about yeah. with patriotic horror. He wrote yeah. Uncle Sam for William Lustig. So he made good movies as a director, but as a writer, I think is where he really shined.
Oh, yeah.
And he also made my favorite Masters of Horror episode, Pick Me Up, which is basically about a bus that breaks down, and they get the people on the bus get caught between a hitchhiker who's a serial killer and a trucker who's a serial killer.
Which I watched earlier this week.
Yeah, the thing I love about it, though, is that it's kind of like Urban Legend Freddy versus Jason. Because the whole shtick is that the hitchhiker kills whoever picks him up, and the trucker kills whoever he picks up. So, yep. Needless to say, they're at odds.
Yep. Yeah, and Firouza Balk is kind of the final girl who finds herself, you know, stuck in between them.
Which, and it's also great. It had some of my favorite, low key acting from the actor who played the trucker, Michael Moriarty.
Yeah, Michael that Moriarty. Was Moriarty. Yeah. Moriarty and Coen were, once they found each other, I think they stuck together because they were.
Oh, he was great with just his low talking, just like the, you know, you really gotta protect yourself, and like that one random scene where he gives a guy a gun for whatever reason, and the guy's like, why, thank you, this is quite generous of you. He's like, yeah, don't worry about it, you gotta just make sure you shoot. Oh, guess I left one in the chamber. She's like, what the fuck's going on with this guy?
Any other Larry Coen that we want to bring up before we get on?
Again, well, I mentioned it briefly before, but love the Maniac Cop movies.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which, again, you know, Coen tackling a rather heavier subject because the first couple movies were, you know, police corruption, because the whole story is about like a good cop who was framed by a bunch of crooked cops where he got killed in prison, and then things get a little muddled. Either he comes back to life as an undead guy, or like he's brain damaged, so he's weird. But either way, like, he manages to come back, and so he goes on a murder spree throughout New York City and puts pressure on the crooked cops that initially put him away. And plus, it's got Bruce Campbell and Tom Atkins. So, like, great casting.
Yeah, he was a true independent spirit, and I think not only influential in the movies he made, but it seems like everybody who saw a Larry Coen movie went on to make movies.
Oh yeah.
Or not everyone who saw a movie, but a lot of the guys working today were Larry Coen fans as well. He was very respected amongst his peers too. So there's the flags are at half mast in the horror world for Larry Coen.
RIP, and if you have the chance, please watch King Coen, the documentary about him.
So let's move on to our topic, which, considering this is our season finale, we were going to talk a little bit about endings. And we're not talking just, you know, like Final Girl Battle or something. We are talking the endings of these movies, meaning like you think everything's done and then there is an ending. I mean, a lot of times this is going to be the last frame of the movie or the last, you know, 15 seconds. But, you know, those endings.
One
that
last
are,
scare.
Yeah, well, that's what it turned out to be in the 80s, was every horror movie had to have that one last scare. And no one did it better, in my opinion, than the Friday the 13th movies.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I wish I could go back and watch the first Friday the 13th movie without knowing that that last scare is coming. And, you know, again, I'm going to spoil a movie that's almost 40 years old, but, you know, the final girl's floating in the boat and peaceful music is playing, and then Jason jumps out. Jason, the young boy Jason, mm-hmm. because, you know, if you are a Scream fan, you know that Jason wasn't the killer in the first Friday the 13th. You know, the young boy Jason launches out of the lake and pulls her in, and that, you know, to little 11-year-old me, 10-year-old me, was terrifying.
Yeah.
Yep. And I've been thinking about it a lot, and the I think the thing that makes that at the ending of the first Friday the 13th so powerful is just because there's no buildup. Like, it just comes out of nowhere that, like, you know, like, undead kid Jason attacks the final girl like that, because the rest of the movie is straight up, you know, more murder mystery, giallo, slasher, you know, it's more grounded. But then that last scare, like, that just, like, flips everything on its head.
There's almost an anti-buildup, because it's the resolution. The threat has already been dealt with, and she just floats off into this river, and the cops are on the shore, and you're like, oh, she's saved.
But it's also this weird, like, dreamlike state where it doesn't feel like it's real. Like, that music is playing, the focus is soft, you know, with how they shot it, it all feels like it doesn't feel right. Like, it's too calm. And then but then all of a sudden, like you said, this undead 11-year-old with a mangled head comes out of the water and drags her in. Like, there's no reference that that's possible in this movie. So the fact that it just comes out of nowhere was a big what the fuck moment.
Yeah. What are some other movies like that? What are your favorites?
Well, the first one that comes to mind for me would have to be Frank Darabont's The Mist.
Yeah.
Because
One's just heartbreaking. Yeah. I mean, that's just a jaw dropper.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, like, I saw that when it came out in 2007, and, like, it crushed my soul after having watched it.
I took a date to that.
Oh, man.
So if you can imagine teenage me, like, for a second viewing, taking a date to that movie.
And you knew it was coming?
Oh, I knew it. Oh, I looked over at them to see their reaction. Like, just
what is wrong with you?
That's terrible.
I think you can already tell there was no second date, but...
it's just such an amazing ending, because, you know, just like, you know, throughout the rest of the movie, it's a survival story, and, you know, there's the monsters and stuff. Is it cool if I say what happens, or?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Fast forward about 20 seconds if you don't want to hear it, but go ahead.
Spoilers for a 12-year-old movie. But yeah, you know, just like Thomas Jane, like, Mercy kills his family and friends because, you know, they think they're still being chased by monsters, and, like, he is just broken down with grief, and he's out of bullets, so he just wants the monster to take him, and then the army comes and saves them, and he's just left there screaming. And I forget the actress's name, but Carol from The Walking Dead is fine with her kids despite having gone off into the mist at, like, the beginning of the movie. So Carol finds a way. But
she was a survivor way back then.
she is such a powerful image, and it just hits you so hard, just out of everything else like that. And, like, I think Stephen King even said that he liked that ending better than his original more ambiguous ending from the novella he wrote. So it's just so powerful, and, like, it's despairing, and it is horrifying in its own way. Like that. Yeah. That one really stuck with me.
Yeah. It's just soul crushing.
Yeah.
What about you, Korea?
I'm not allowed to talk about one ending that's just like in my mind right now because it's too recent of a movie and spoilers, you know?
Right. Is it something that we haven't seen yet or have?
Let's just say something that we all discussed earlier had a pretty fucking amazing ending. Okay. And y'all are going to love it. That's it. But another one that, but to get back away from that, one that really stuck out was Freddy versus Jason. Say what you will for most of that movie. Definitely the super not Jason Mewes J character ruined it for a good portion of the movie. But once it got to the, but once you had Freddy and Jason interacting through, even before their big fight scene, all their interactions were brilliant. And then you get the final fight and it was like two like titans fighting and it was amazing. But you can't just say who's going to win. So they get throw in that twist, you know, spoils for a movie that's fucking 16 years old now. But, you know, Freddy or Jason cuts off Freddy's head. And then it ends with him holding Freddy's head and it winks at the screen, like, which raises so many questions. Is this a dream? Did all this really happen? Because Freddy doesn't have these powers in the real world. Does he have these powers in the real world? Is Jason just dreaming at this point and Freddy's in his head? What's going on here? What happened to a lot of these actors' careers after this movie? You know,
we should have probably said at the beginning of this that, yeah, since we're talking about endings, we're going to be spoiling. Going to be spoiling shit.
Oh, yeah.
But one that I am not going to spoil, but I am going to talk about as far as last second scares, because it is pretty recent. The movie Enemy, which we have talked about.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the one we talked about a while back that you projected wrong and no one believed you because it's that weird of a movie.
and the audio, like, people would be talking and it would be like... It's like, come on.
But it has the ending. And when I say ending, I'm talking last few frames.
Yeah.
And then, you know, credits roll. And then you're just thinking, you're like, wait, what the hell did I just see? You know, you're like, how does this relate to the rest of the movie? It's, yeah, it's just one of those, you know, what? You rewind. Like one of those deals.
It's so good. And since we talked about it the other week, I actually got a digital copy of Prisoners for pretty cheap. And so,
oh man,
I was going to watch that this weekend, but got too busy.
That's another one. Talk about endings. It's another soul crushing ending, which have you seen it before?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Then I won't spoil it for you because, you know, hell, we'll spoil it for our listeners, but I'm not going to spoil it for you. But just know that the way that it ends, and it does have another one of those last frame ending kind of a things, but it is like that movie's 2 hours and 10 minutes long, and you want it to be 2 hours and 15 because you want to see what happens then. But all of a sudden, you know, the credits are rolling. You're like, oh, wait, no, you can't leave me like this.
Right.
And they do. Yeah. So anyway, Prisoners is good if you've got the stomach for it. It's a hard movie to watch.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if, well, I mean, none of us have kids, but if it's probably tougher if you have kids because it's basically about a child abduction and they're, you know, trying to solve it. But it's one of those, not quite as bad as The Mist, but it is soul crushing as well.
Yeah.
What about the big daddy of all final frame endings, Sleepaway Camp?
Oh, you fuck. No.
who has seen Sleepaway Camp and does not have that image ingrained? Even if you haven't seen it, you probably have that image ingrained in your mind because it's a meme.
Yeah.
I will say, I do not like Sleepaway Camp. I had a little bit more fun with the sequels. For some reason, I watched them. It's that Scream Factory Collector's Edition addiction I have. But... Yeah. Where I have to own them all with the slipcovers. Fuckers.
Gotta catch them all.
Yeah, and pretty soon I'll be owning Green Inferno, dicks. Anyway, Sleepaway Camp is just like a very anticlimactic like slasher with like some weird, it tries to implement like some weird psychosexual like bullshit that does not land. And then all of a sudden at the end it's like, wait a minute, it was a little girl, but she's not a little girl. And then you just see a lot of pube and penis.
Oh, and also her creepy like screaming face was like
Yeah.
Apparently was a dude in a mask. It wasn't actually Felissa Rose.
Which is why her face didn't move.
Yeah.
Which made it weird because the noises she was making, like people keep saying it's a screaming face, and the face was modeled to scream, but she was just going,
it's more hissing. Like.
But I will say this. I knew the ending was coming, and I didn't realize how much I wasn't going to like the film, and I was watching it with my girlfriend, now fiance, and I will say this, it was entertaining as fuck to see her reaction to that ending, because she hated the movie just as much as I did, and then all of a sudden she went, wait, what the fuck was that? Like, seriously? Is that supposed to explain stuff? I'm like, yes, the fact that it was a boy raised to be a girl is the reason why I emerged. She's like, seriously? Seriously, that's the motivation behind this fucking movie? I'm like, it got two sequels. It got two sequels? I'm like,
I'm the opposite. Yeah. I hate the sequels because I think the sequels are just killing for the sake of killing. And not that all slashers aren't, but I think the sequels are just, there's no point to it, just going around and mean-spirited killing. But I think that there's actually a point, and I think that there's a point to Sleepaway Camp, and I think that for me, the psychosexual stuff does kind of land because they show enough flashback to like the mom and, you know, for me, the psychosexual stuff works in Sleepaway Camp. I'm the opposite of you. I don't like the sequels, but I like the original movie. Another one of those last like final scare deals that is legendary, at least to me, Pieces.
Oh, God, yes.
Pieces is one. The tagline to it is, you don't need to go to Texas for a chainsaw massacre. And the other tagline is, it's exactly what you think it is. And it is. It's a chainsaw movie. But it always got me because it was one of those VHS covers that said, you know, like, unrated, too scary for theaters, banned in America, see this movie, you know, so of course, you know, mom, dad, rent me this, and it's pretty much just a typical chainsaw massacre movie, but there is a final scare that is to die for.
Unbelievable.
Don't spoil it for me, because I haven't seen this one, and you can shame me all you want, but I just haven't gotten around to it.
Yeah. It's another one of those. I wish I could watch it for the first time, but now you know there's a final scare coming, but you don't know what it is.
Yeah, there's just so much about that movie that is inexplicable, and you know, it's one of those types of movies that kind of drives on its own logic. Like, again, without spoiling, there's a scene involving Kung Fu that just has no context and no possible explanation. It just is. And that's what makes Pieces great.
It's sort of like the pancake scene from Cabin Fever, or the Garbage Day one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like just one of those random...
random Kung Fu scene. Why not? Although, if we're talking final scares for horror movies, I gotta bring up Phantasm.
Yeah,
because that is a legendary scare. You know, like Jody thinks, you know, things are settled, and you know, and the entire movie is on dream logic, so it kind of jumps back and forth. But then, you know, it's kind of the final scene is like Mike, his brother, is dead, and he's with Reggie, who you thought was dead but is actually alive. And you know, they're just trying to get on. He's grieving, and then. And then the tall man pops up for one last time to say, boy, and Jody gets dragged into the mirror. Like the first time I saw that, scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
Right, what else we got endings wise? Let's start rounding this down.
Well, I was going to ask, what is the worst last second twist, last second scare,
last second
that you can think of? Because I got one in mind. And I think I bitched about it before.
Oh, go! You go first, then.
Valentine. Remember that?
I never seen that.
Yeah, I don't remember the last second scare, though.
Well, Valentine was one of those post-Scream slasher films from the early 2000s, and it had Denise Richards, who I think when we talked about it before, I said was like one of the better parts of the film, which is a testament to how bad that movie is when Denise Richards is the best part. But she seriously killed it in that movie. But like the whole time, like the killer through his mask gets a bloody nose every time he kills someone, which was fucking stupid because his nose isn't even that, like, it's such a big mask, like why would it be bleeding out there? I'm not getting into the semantics of that bullshit, but the big twist at the end was that it was David Boreanaz the entire time, even though like you could call it from a mile away, and they did like a few stupid like little fake outs that it wasn't him. but it just ends with like him holding her, holding like the final girl, and then all of a sudden his nose starts bleeding, and it's like, really, really, movie, you did the most obvious thing and tried to fake us out, but and like made it impossible for it to be him, and then we're just like, no, it was him this entire time.
I think the worst one for me, and I hate to say it because I love the movie, it's in my top 10, the original Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
The last scare, it's like, it comes out, it's like, you know, she, you know, the mom is like, I think I'm gonna quit drinking, I just don't feel like it anymore, and then they get in the car, and then the Freddy sweater hood comes up, and
awesome.
You know,
I didn't like that either, the car, the Freddy hood, yeah, car hood.
I like the Freddy car bit. It was the very clear dummy that
yeah.
gets, because like I thought the ending was great, but I just hated that it was very obvious, like an inflatable doll that gets ripped into the door.
Yeah, that's actually, that was my, I mean, the whole thing with the mom, I actually did kind of like the Freddy hood, because also that said to me, okay, they're still in dreamland, you know, yeah. and they didn't get him. But yeah, the whole thing, the mom with, I just don't feel like drinking, and then yeah. getting dragged through that tiny little, where you're like, oh, come on. Yeah, that's mine. Can you think of one that you think is stupid, Jacob? He loves them all. He doesn't have a bad.
Okay. I've been thinking it over, and this is going to be a controversial one. I did not care for the ending of Tenebrae. Argento's Tenebrae.
Explain.
Because, yeah, you know, the big twist is that it turns out it's the author, Peter Neal, which was cool. I just didn't really like the resolution because, like, he manages to trick the cops with, like, a fake razor to make it look like he cut himself. And then he kills everybody, and he's about to kill, I think, like, his assistant or, like, like the last person alive who's on his staff, the final girl, and then like the door's wedged with like a statue, and like she pushes it open, and like a piece of it impales him to the wall, and it just ends with her, with them screaming and her dying, with him dying and her screaming, and I mean it's just so abrupt and just, you know, that's it. It just wasn't very satisfying, and you know, kind of came out of nowhere.
So you're questioning the reality of an Argento movie? Is that what you're
maybe,
doing?
Maybe a little.
All right, we got any final thoughts on endings? Final thoughts on endings.
I got one. Okay. In terms of franchise endings, some of my favorites are from the Evil Dead franchise. I feel like they ended each movie very well, you know, because the Evil Dead ends with one last scare, the evil jumping at Ash, then Evil Dead 2 ends with the bridging to Army of Darkness with Ash in medieval times, and then Army of Darkness, you know, bit of a split because there was the original ending where he drank too much of the sleeping potion, end up in
which I love.
Dystopian future, which, yeah, it's fun in its own way, but I'm glad that we also got the happier and more fun badass ending where it just ends with him back at S-Mart and fighting off some last-minute deadites. And, yeah, so that I felt like those were each pretty fun and satisfying in their own way.
That was, like, one of the few cases where, like, studio meddling kind of came out with a better product because... Yeah. As much as I do love the original ending, the happier ending did give us Hail to the King, Baby, which I felt like was kind of like Sam Raimi and companies like, fuck you to the studio, where they're like, we want a happier ending. And they're like, fine, we're going to come up with the cheesiest, greatest ending ever.
And
the cheese
did.
Worked.
Yeah.
It was nice cheesy.
No, it was great cheese. I'd throw that on some nachos.
I think my favorite... from a franchise point of view, it's probably the Friday the 13th, because every one of them has, you know, jumping through a window, or even as simple as him just like kind of opening his eyes so you know that he's not dead, you know, when he's at the bottom of the lake, you know, those, or and then there's the obvious, you know, Jason goes to hell that sets up Freddy versus Jason.
Yes.
But yeah, I think from a franchise standpoint, I think the Friday the 13th ones are the best.
For me, from my standpoint, franchise-wise, I'd go with George A. Romero's The Dawn, the original Dead trilogy. Even Land still had a great ending. So, the Dead Quadrilogy always had, like, a nice, strong ending, whether it's, like, pausing to, like, reflect on, like, the events that happened with it or just ending on a strong note. He kind of wrapped it. The later ones, not so much. Diary was like probably the last one I had fun with, but I haven't seen that one since theaters.
Actually, I was just thinking, I kind of like the ending to Diary, like, because it did have that kind of pointy moment where, like, the camera person like brought up some footage of like hunters just killing zombies for sport, and you know them and the filmmakers, you know, bunkering down. So like, I feel like that at its moments. But yeah, no, I feel George A. Romero had a really great affinity for ending his movies.
Yeah,
cool. And with that, let's end our discussion of endings, and therefore end our first season. Look at this. We made it one season in, and they said it wouldn't last. And here we are.
All those naysayers, i.e. Jacob.
Hey.
And for the entire first season, and probably into the second, because I have no desire to change it, our music was Restless Spirit. I almost said DMP. It's still hard for me to wrap my head around that they changed their name. But anyway, Restless Spirit is our music. So go rock with them. And our artwork, which we should get Chris to do to change up our artwork for second season.
Yeah, let's set him up.
Yeah, yeah. There we go. So anyway, the artwork is Chris Fisher. So hire him to draw something for you, but don't get put in the queue before us because we might need him. And me, you can find on Twitter at CinemaFearite. That's F-E-A-R-I-T-E, like verite, but fear. Where can we find you guys on Twitter, Jacob?
You can find me at Jacob Davison _. That is at JACOBDAVISON _.
And how about you, Korea?
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Korean Barbecue. That's CORREIANBBQ. And also you can follow us on Stardust. Been a little lazy with that lately, but with all these new films and stuff I've been seeing lately, I'm definitely posting more on there, especially with Twilight Zone episode reviews. So check us out there, and yeah.
And you can find all three of us at the Eye on Horror Facebook page, which you should definitely go to and like if you don't already. And you can find all three of us at iHorror.com, because that's where we all write, and iHorror.com's Facebook page. So have I covered all of the social media bases for everything?
Oh, yeah.
I think we're there. Okay, then we're going to get out of here. We will see you next season. For me, James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
And I'm Jonathan Korea.
Keep your eye on horror.
Rampage.